What was the movie with a robot cop? RoboCop.
Oh, that's great.
What are you laughing at?
I was going to say something.
Well, this is a podcast, unless you should say it, unless it's not appropriate.
It wasn't appropriate.
Okay. All right. Well, that's how we start the show. How's it going, John?
It's gone.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Good Day, Sir podcast.
Yeah, they're biannual now.
Today is April 7th, 2024. This is episode number 320. What season are we in? Don't you like when podcasts do that? This is season 12, episode 6 of the... Do podcasts have seasons? Is that a
I've seen volumes and seasons and
you know what,
series
podcast seasons are just another example of cutting the ends off the roast.
Yeah,
that's one of my metaphors that has really stuck at our company. Do you know this metaphor?
Yeah, you've said it several times. Oh, share it with the audience, because
okay, well, I'm sure I've heard it.
I think it's good.
Okay, so gosh, I haven't told the story in forever. Basically, I'll screw this up, but it goes something like this. So, you know, you'll have a person who is cooking a roast, and they got their recipe from their grandma. It's been passed down from maybe their great grandma, and it just passes from generation to generation to generation. And what they do is when they're preparing the roast before it goes in the oven, they just cut the ends off of maybe a couple inches off of each end. And, you know, one day someone says, well, why are you cutting the ends off the roast? And the person says, well, that's the right way to do it, because that we're using grandma's recipe, and that's, you know, that's how she always did it. And next time they have a big family event where grandma, who thankfully is still with us in this story, grandma comes over, and they're like, hey, grandma, remind us again, why don't we cut the ends off the roast? And she says, oh, well, I have a really small oven, and I have to use a small pan, and the roast literally won't fit in my pan if I usually don't cut a little bit of off of the end. Okay, so why are you still cutting the ends off the roast? But anyway, it's such a great metaphor because it works for all kinds of business situations. We're in consulting, and we often come across, you know, part of our job is we're looking at processes, how things are done, how things are currently implemented, and because unfortunately, you know, the way things are currently implemented, and everyone's what's it called, existing conventional wisdom, It taints our thought process. It taints everyone's thought process. It biases you. As soon as it enters your brain, you're now psychologically biased by how things are already done.
Mm-hmm. The ceremony of it.
But we don't realize it's ceremony. I think it's human nature just to take it as you cut the ends off the roast. And so we really try to talk about that a lot at our company. It's like, let's make sure we're not cutting the ends off the roast on these things. Let's make sure we know why we're doing something. Mm-hmm. And ask. And of course, that's one of the hallmarks of a good consultant, right? Or a business analyst or whatever, even architect or almost anything, is asking good questions.
Yeah.
Challenging assumptions. Oh, assumptions. They're
so bad.
They're
I think so I'm dangerous. Pretty good at asking questions. I wonder if I get to the annoying side when I ask questions. Or I think I get this feeling like if people think I'm being obstructive with how many questions I'm asking.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, don't cut the ends off the roast.
Yeah.
And if you do, know why you're doing it. Mm-hmm. Well, John, it's cleaning day here apparently at the Good Day, Sir studio, so we might hear some vacuuming, or who knows, when trash cans being emptied. Did we record 2 weeks ago, or was it 3 weeks ago?
I think it was about
three.
I want to say two.
Okay, but yeah, there was they were doing construction in here then, right? Yeah. Is that what it was? Yeah, hell, that noise. But yeah. Well, maybe we can get a good clean recording here.
Maybe.
if the podcast gods.
It's quiet now.
We'll allow it.
It's moved on to the other part of the building.
Maybe, hopefully so. Anyway. Well, John, what have you been up to?
Work, life.
What's happening?
All the stuff.
What's happening in the world of John's?
I could tell you my drive up here sucked, and I made some observations.
Oh, here we go. John's observations.
I just want to say, I think technology is making us super stupid.
Yes.
So I was driving in my neighborhood, and I have a feeling this is a pilot. Like some company paid our city and gave them some money or something, or convinced somebody somewhere to do this in our town. But we now have solar panels attached to our static stop signs in a four-way stop with LEDs around it flashing.
Oh, I see those sometimes.
And I'm like, what is this doing?
Well, those are high accident intersections.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Either that or someone just getting kickbacks on this technology.
That's my thought. I mean, it is a fairly congested four-way stop because it leads up to a church and a school.
Yeah.
Well, two schools. But I've never seen any major incidents there. And I mean, I drive by there all the time.
Yeah.
So for me to say this is a death trap right here.
Yeah. I mean, with all those, you just said a school's in a church. I mean, for all those kids and people and everything, it's why wait for someone to get, you know, creamed before you put in a, you know, a nice little.
That's the argument they probably use.
I'm sure.
But how much is safety worth? How much is a person's life worth? Right. We need to put LEDs on this thing. It's like my brother, he started putting LEDs all over his room. And I'm my younger brother. Well, not younger anymore.
when you guys were kids or?
No. This is now. This is my
now. Okay.
My younger brother who's a grown man.
A grown ass man.
A grown ass man. He got into, he all of a sudden decided he wanted LEDs on everything. And he started putting LEDs pretty much everywhere.
Was he 16?
I think he does a lot of retail therapy.
Okay.
And so this was one.
Because like LED strips or what? What are we talking about here?
Strips, lighting, anything. Like he was into he bought tons of guitars for a while. That he was retail therapy with guitars, and then he got into LEDs. I think he was doing some VR gaming stuff that he was really getting into. So I think he does a lot of retail therapy, and at some point he got into LEDs.
Yeah.
So everything he was telling me about was all these new LED things. Like you can get these LED tiles; they're super expensive. But you can get these LED tiles and you can put them on your wall and then you can program them to have like a GIF image or something on them.
Oh, wow.
And it looks pretty cool. But if you were to cover a wall with it, it'd be pretty pricey.
Yeah.
So anyways, it reminded me of that. I'm like, they're just sticking on LEDs on everything now.
Is he sending you photos of this or how are you?
He has, but I don't keep them. Like they go in my text message, but I'll never save them, which I appreciate that images and text messages don't go directly to my photos library.
Where does he live now?
Arizona. Yeah.
Phoenix area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, still out there in the desert.
All right, John. Well, should we get into some?
Oh, I'm not finished with that.
All right.
Two cars waving around on the road.
Mm.
Teslas. So I know they got lane assisting.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's some kid rifling around with their phone or some Uber driver trying to find their next pickup.
Yeah.
No, it's old ladies both times. I'm like, someone needs to show them how to put the lane assist on or something, because they were, I don't know what they were doing, but they were fumbling around in their car for some reason.
That can't be worse than Frisco, man.
But you think this so technology bad. That's supposed to make us safer is going to make us safer, and people...
I think it will.
I don't... Is it?
I think it will. I mean, we're not there yet, but we will. I mean, I think this... speaking of Tesla, the FSD is getting, you know, reports are about to be released. And it's getting really, really good. So also, I heard someone the other day, I think it was a tweet I saw, but I think they were in San Francisco or somewhere where there's Waymo, but they said they took several Ubers, several Waymos, and then something else, I forget. But their takeaway was just like, Waymo is just going to kill everything. It's going to kill Uber.
Mm. They're just the newest unicorn.
Stop. John?
I like touching it. Sorry.
I know. Just if something is... You hear that?
It is. It's catches it's and then this. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, stop touching it, John. I told you that. but I think Tesla will get in the Waymo business. That business of driverless.
Sure.
What's this called? Driverless rides, right? Driverless rides or whatever.
Autonomous.
Yeah.
Ride sharing or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
There you go. Anyway.
I don't know. I think there's a certain, the more we take away from our responsibility, you know, keeping your eyes on the road, staying in the lane, the less we're adept at doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's just going to make us all around worse drivers, worse people in general.
Well, John, let's get on to the show. I'm going to kick us off with, and I don't have anything super, just to have everyone stop listening right now, I'm just going to say I don't have a lot of topical stuff, but this is interesting. So you know, Jason Fried, he's one of the 30, what are they called now? It's not 37 Signals. Are they just called Basecamp? I don't know what they're called, but He says, something happened to business software. You used to pay for it once, install it, and run it, whether on someone's computer or a server for everyone. It felt like you owned it, and you did. Today, most software is a service, not owned, but rented. Buying it enters you into a perpetual landlord-tenant agreement. Every month, you pay for essentially the same thing you had last month. And if you stop paying, the software stops working. Boom, you're evicted.
Mm-hmm.
For nearly two decades, the SaaS model benefited landlords handsomely. With routine prayers and payers, to the church of recurring revenue, valuation shot to the moon on a moonshot. On the backs of businesses subscribed at luxury prices for a commodity service they had little control over. Add up your SaaS subscriptions last year. You should own that shit by now. SaaS still makes sense for many products, but its grip will slip. Installation and administration used to be hopelessly complicated, but self-hosting tech is simpler now and vastly improved. Plus, IT departments are hungry to run their own IT again, tired of being subservient to big tech's rain clouds, REIGN. Rain.
That's a good pun.
Once upon a time, you owned what you paid for, you controlled what you depended on, and your privacy and security were your own business. We think it's that time again. So they famously are in the process, I think, well on their way to ditching AWS, or I think they were AWS, and going basically completely to, like, I think they're, you know, they have like a more of like a co-located model. So they're probably, maybe they're, I don't know if they're renting just entire whole servers or if they are literally buying and putting and having their own servers put in, one of the two, but those are kissing cousins. They're almost the same thing.
Yeah.
In a way. But, and they say, you know, they publish some story about it and how they've, you know, saved just so much money, which is interesting because on the one hand you hear how, the narrative is that, you know, AWS and all these cloud infrastructure providers have dramatically reduced. It's constant price reductions, constant price cutting. And usually AWS leads, and so AWS will, you know, start do some price cut across the board, and then everyone else has to respond. And just, it happens, you know, it seems like it happens all the time. But then there's some things that they just absolutely kill you on. Like AWS kills you on egress. Like you can get all your, they make it cheap to get everything. It's the Roach Motel. It's cheap to get in, but getting any data out is literally like 10 to 100 times more expensive. And so just getting, you know, they make it seem cheap. It, you know, when you're just looking at, hey, what's, you know, what are these, you know, we need an RDS for a database and, you know, some DNS service and some load balancers and a bunch of web servers, right? Or, you know, whatever. Amazon uses for web service. We know where you're using Elastic Beanstalk or any number of these things, or maybe just Kubernetes and whatever. It looks inexpensive, but then when you start, you know, when you look at stuff like egress and things like that, you really realize that if you don't include that in your model, you can be missing like solidly half of what your bill will be. And people, I think, get locked in and they start, you know, they get these big bills and they realize there's not a whole lot they can do about it other than just replatforming.
Yeah.
This is also why, I mean, I think, you know, something like Kubernetes is just so, it's so important because you can define your entire application. And when I say application, I mean like, you know, these big applications, I mean, like something like Salesforce, like when they replatform to AWS, I mean, I'm sure it's Kubernetes from top to bottom. I don't know. Maybe some Salesforce engineer can correct us if I'm wrong about that, but I bet it's, you know, I bet there's a lot of Kubernetes. And once you, you know, kind of replatform to Kubernetes, you can kind of, you can take that anywhere. If you want to run on AWS, you can run on AWS. You want to run on Microsoft or Google, you can do that. If you want to run your own infrastructure, you can manage your own Kubernetes clusters and, you know, do it on your colo or whatever. It's really the, you know, because you and I have kind of laughed slash debated about, you know, standardized APIs and, oh, you know, make sure you don't use stored procedures and all this kind of stuff, because then you can change your database or you can change whatever. And you're kind of, I think, the classic, like, oh, that's kind of bullshit. You're not going to change.
Yeah.
And I think I don't disagree with that necessarily. Maybe I think it's a little more possible than you, but it's important to be able to have that threat, at least as just from a business perspective. And for these big vendors to know that, hey, you know, we've we've programmed against, you know, the JMS API instead of like directly against your, you know, super expensive message broker's proprietary API. So we can leave. And just the fact that these vendors of database stuff or messaging stuff or anything that you're building on that's got APIs, mm-hmm. if you're using these standardized APIs, you know, all these vendors, and they can push you a little bit and bully you a little bit, but they know that if they push too hard, that like you're gonna bite that bullet and take the cost of switching.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt like that's important, which is weird when we entered into this kind of the SaaS world. Everyone's like, vendor neutrality standards, APIs, who cares about that? And everyone's just like, let's jump right into that SaaS roach motel, you know, head first and not even asking any questions.
Right.
Vendor neutrality, who cares about that? Vendor lock-in, sorry, is what I was really thinking. You know, vendor lock-in, who cares, you know?
But I think that's also on the tail end of that. That's going to lead companies like AWS to push for longer, more stricter contracts. So the idea that move anywhere, you know, they'll of course make the sales pitch look really attractive. I can't stop touching it. they'll of course try to make it look really attractive, and then they'll lock you into that price point. They'll be like, hey, we'll get you a really nice price point if you're at least for 3, 5, 10 years, you know.
Yeah, and you know, as much as I do appreciate this cloud model, because we all know that if you really want to be a cloud, you have to be able to, it has to be elastic, and you have to only be charged for what you use, and you should be able to change what you're using and how much you're using at any point in time without asking for permission, without being locked in or anything else. Because, you know, we've all been told,
beware of the false cloud.
You know, if your vendor requires you to sign, you know, multi-year contracts with massive commitments that have nothing to do with your usage model, mm-hmm. then maybe it's not really cloud. And as much as the big infrastructure companies are pretty good at this, if you're big enough, you have to go down the path of negotiating. Totally normal. Mm-hmm. If you're big enough, you actually do pre-commit and negotiate, and you get better rates on stuff. You kind of can't afford not to at that scale.
Right.
So the bigger you are, the less it starts looking like a truly scalable cloud model. The right. more it looks more like, you know, you're doing business with Salesforce.
Right. Exactly.
So, I mean, cause and again, at some point the vendor and to, you know, not like to pick on Salesforce, but in their defense too, like if you're big enough, they need to know what you are committing to buying, so the vendor can commit to making sure those resources are available.
Yeah.
Now the idea with public cloud is like they've got so many customers that it's like the law of averages or big numbers or whatever. I don't even know if those are actually laws. People talk about that all the time. Such that, you know, any one customer, even if they, you know, 100x their usage, it's going to be just a blip on your radar.
Yeah.
But I think the reality is that at some scale, at very large scales, you need those big customers to commit and to forecast what they're going to use.
Yeah. Well, I think what's also important in that discussion is it's not just the technology that people are buying. I mean, in some ways it is, but I think what makes AWS attractive, especially to Salesforce, who called AWS the false cloud.
Who was he referring to?
I thought it was AWS. It was Amazon.
It
could have been Oracle, but I thought it was Amazon.
That can't be. It has to be Oracle. It has to be Oracle.
I don't know. Oracle was barely doing anything cloud-like.
Well, maybe that's...
Well, so you had Amazon, and then you had Oracle, who was doing Amazon-like stuff, with trying to say, we'll host everything in this cloud infrastructure. So I think you're right. It might have been Oracle, because I think what they were doing is they were just taking all your apps and hosting it on their servers.
Yeah.
And not true cloud computing. So I think that's what he was referring to.
What was the original model? The ASP model, application service provider.
Yeah.
They would just run your application for you in their data center.
Yeah, that's what Microsoft was doing too at the time.
Oh, yeah, that was big.
Yeah.
This is early 2000s, I think, right? Maybe it was late 90s even.
Yeah.
ASP.
But anyways, popping the stack, I think what right now what makes Amazon attractive is the global markets. It's penetrating the other markets, especially with constraints like GDPR, data residency, Even just being able to set up a data center internationally is a huge hurdle.
Yeah.
And then also just the hardware constraints of being able to get hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all of those factors is what drives all these companies to go to these clouds versus hosting them themselves, even though they would like to, and they technically are capable of it. There's just still some factors there that are hard to overcome.
Right, right. Yeah, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway. All right. I got a couple other news items. I can just keep going. I know you did you have something?
Yeah, I have a couple things.
All right, why don't you take something while I get us another beer? By the way, beer today is brought to you by Monkish, which is I'm always happy when I get a shipment of I got a buddy who gets he's got some they call him a proxy who goes to the brewery in whatever state it is, buys the beer for them or picks up their membership allotment or whatever it is, and then ships it to you because it's illegal for the breweries to ship beer for some dumb reason. But anyway, yeah, this is from Monkish. I think actually everything I brought is Monkish. This is a double hazy IPA. It's called Monk Cat. It's pretty cool art, huh?
Yeah, I like it. It's pretty cool.
I think I'm gonna go West Coast now. But anyway, you can get to your topic while I do that.
All right. I'll go for an easy one since you're gonna be distracted. This came across on Salesforce's I've noticed that Salesforce on their news and insights, they're pretty consistent with posting on that. It's all kind of fluff in my opinion, but this one gave me a bit of the ick. The title of this one is Salesforce Futures, Personal AI Agents Will Forever Change Customer Company Relationships. So I'll just read a little bit. The transformation promise of personal AI agents, artificial intelligence systems designed to assist people with everyday tasks like scheduling a doctor's appointment, writing an email, or recommending a book lies in their ability to compensate for human limitations. Anyone who struggles to finish one task during a busy day, let alone juggle many of them, can understand why this would be useful. And man, is that just nothing.
Of course.
I don't even know what to say, because the next part of it is what gives me the real ick. But even just that sentence alone of how they're trying to sell or pitch this kind of personal assistant, it's just that's the wrong use for AI, in my opinion. It's a nothing thing.
Why is AI not a valid use case for personal? I mean, why is personal assistant not a valid use case?
Because it's not solving a problem that either we can't solve ourselves or that we can't solve ourselves without mass, I guess, without having a ton of people helping you.
I don't know.
Here's a better way of saying it. It's the equivalent of going to Dreamforce and them pitching you on Mercedes and yachts. Look at all this technology that they were using for these Mercedes and these yachts. I mean, how many of us are so busy, have so many things going on in our day that we need these personal AI assistants to write an email for us, to schedule an appointment for us, all of those kind of things.
As someone who hates doing both of those things, I would welcome that, honestly. Or like, you know, I mean, imagine you come in Monday morning, you sit down at 8:30 and your assistant says, hey, I've looked at your Slack, your emails and all this other stuff. And here's like the three things you should probably do before 10 a.m. That's kind of cool. Or it summarizes what's happening or whatever those. I mean, I think that's where AI is reasonably capable and makes sense. I mean, the whole thing we're like, oh, we're going to like refactor all your company's source code and something better. I still think that's way far away, you know?
Well, I think that's, and
hey, John, what if it could deploy? What if it could do seamless deployments of your Salesforce code base for you?
That would be a real use of AI.
That's a real use case.
That would be a true Einstein, that if it could just deploy my Salesforce.
Yeah, I don't want to hear the word Einstein until it can do that.
That's, yeah. Well, there's a point I'm a bit negative on that viewpoint of personal assistance, because I think it doesn't come from a practical perspective like you just mentioned. I think it comes from an elitist perspective. Okay. Because the next subtitle is Infinite Interns and Patients. Imagine an army of infinite patient interns who stand ready to work on your behalf. These interns can either collaborate alongside you in the flow of your work, or they can labor independently, periodically checking in to ensure they're on the right track. The more they work with you, the smarter they get, learning how you work and think across modes and contexts. Think about a world where all of us have the kind of expert staff currently enjoyed by CEOs. Gifted helpers who learn our preferences, understand our goals, engineer outcomes, and specialize in doing all the things we don't want to do.
Got a title out of that.
Oh my God, that just, I wanted to throw up in my mouth with that.
I got a title from that. Gifted helpers.
Gifted helpers. The first word that jumped in my head was slave, first of all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like iRobot slave here.
Yeah.
We're just inventing or projecting our future here. But it's just, it's this elitist idea that we're just all so important. Like these phones. You know who used to have phones and pagers? Doctors who need to be immediately accessed so they can get to the hospital and help people. Now we all have these things. Now we all have to be connected. We're all so important.
And they're good. They're good. You get a lot of value out of it.
True.
You're actually making the point, John. Damn it. Foiled again.
Foiled again. I worry for humanity. I think we give up too much of our skill, too much of our thought processes. And for what? Because we think that by having these assistants, we're going to be able to get more done, or that we're going to be able to dedicate more time to our family and do all those kind of things. Honestly, I don't think it translates to that.
No,
I think it translates to more work.
It does.
It's like, yeah. It's like,
because more will be expected from us. Oh, you got all this AI stuff. You can get more done, right, John?
Yeah, exactly.
You're thinking, wait, I thought I was going to like be able to only work a 40-hour work week now. No. Oh, no. We expect you to get more done because we're going to pay $20 a month for an AI for you to have GitHub Copilot or like or Einstein Copilot.
Yeah. Well, fundamentally, I think we do it to ourselves. I think we as we gain more free time, we quickly fill it with stuff.
We do. Of course.
Think about when you were younger and you're making maybe 20 a year or something. Now let's say you've 10x that. Do you have more money, free money floating around?
No.
Chances are no. You've filled it with more stuff that you have to pay for now, that you have to maintain.
Mainly the problem is inflation.
Okay, we'll take that out of the picture. But I mean, think about how you used to live. You survived on 20.
Yeah.
But let's say you're making 200 now.
Yeah.
I mean, but now you've got the big house. Now you've got the nice car. Now you've got four kids and the dogs. And
that's my fault, not anyone else's. I've raised my requirements.
We don't live in a world where we have excess and we enjoy that excess. We fill, in terms of time, we fill that void with stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't think tools like these lead to a euphoric utopia where we're just able to relax.
No,
we're able to float around in our floaty chairs and be fat people.
No, you will own nothing. You will eat bugs and you'll be happy. That's where we're going with this.
Anyways, I think there's good uses for this. I'm being obviously facetious here, but the wording of this was pretty funny and poor in my take.
You like making fun of the rhetoric.
I do.
Rhetoric.
It was.
Yeah. Well, you know, people still don't know what to think about this. And even the people that are the organizations that are creating some of the stuff, they're you know.
Oh, well, here's a good tangent if you want to go into it.
Okay.
Because we didn't get to talk about this last week, and I had it on my list, but apparently UK had done some big trial on a 4-day work week, and a lot of companies were keeping it. And I was like, I like the idea of it, but I don't know if it would actually play out that way.
Well, so, yeah, they work less than us in the UK. They get a lot more vacation.
The sabbaticals.
And they make a lot less money. So. Maybe it evens out.
Maybe. How would you feel about a 4-day work week? It already feels like I don't have enough days and hours to get everything done.
I mean, if one day of rest was good enough for God, it's good enough for me, John.
So now you're God.
Not exactly what I said.
That's what I took from that.
Not exactly what I said.
I like the idea of it. I just don't know if it's practical.
So I've been involved in two companies that were very seriously, and they were both kind of like startups. We're like, we have a 4-day work week and we're sticking to that. Did they stick to it? No, they
did
not.
I doubt it.
No, they did not.
I bet because it was a 4-day work week, you were working 10-hour days.
These were both companies that served B2B companies,
mm-hmm.
served their customers for businesses. And the problem is when your customers are working, they expect you to be working. Like if you're just like, hey, yeah, literally 20% of the days of the time that you're going to need us, we are going to be, you know, sitting at the bar, sipping cocktails and not answering our email and phones. Right. And it just doesn't, if you can make it work, that's great. I think, you know, product companies maybe. But
there's certain industries that are probably better suited for this.
Especially consumer companies, that really wouldn't work. I mean, just consumer companies, man, they expect people to be available all the time. I don't know.
Yeah. The reason I call it a tangent, because I was wondering, you know, does AI even make that better? Does it make it more achievable that you can get more done with fewer hours in the day, or that where you would normally need to have someone on staff, or maybe 10 people on staff, you can cut that down to 2 people on staff because you've got more bots, so to speak, filling in the gaps so that you can have less people on staff or less people working on, say, a given day.
I don't know. I mean, maybe AI will make that more possible. Did we talk about this company? I know I had it on my notes, but it was a couple months ago. But this company, I think they're Klarma. Is that what it was? But they ended up laying off. They did a big trial of AI support agents, went super well, supposedly. I mean, if you believe their press release, and they laid off 70% of their support staff, which was, I think, in the 4 figures of people.
Well, sometimes it feels like you're getting a robot on some of these support staff.
Well, you might as well be
that
a robot.
Might be,
so bad.
That'd be more indicative of the type of support they were getting before.
Oh, it was crappy. It was crappy. I'm sure it was crappy support.
Yeah. Got to get to that tier 3 support.
I know. hang on a second. Head itches.
Wash it.
Okay. Well, Microsoft is, it's not clear to me if they're being forced to do this. I know they were in the somewhere, I think in the EU zone, but Microsoft said it's splitting up the Teams and Office bundles following scrutiny from European regulators. Did you see this?
Mm-mm.
So I guess the way you got Teams was through Office. And so when you bought, you know, when you buy these business licenses for Office, that's how you get Teams.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of have to buy Office. And now they're splitting that up. I know they had previously already split it up, I think in certain countries. I thought I saw Switzerland and a couple others, which is kind of weird. Now I guess they're just doing that worldwide now. Now this article points out that Slack has long pined for this type of split, and they had submitted an antitrust complaint to the EU in 2020 over what it viewed as illegal tying of Teams into Office. And with Microsoft's latest announcement, some customers will have to pay more money to get the same features. Of course, they're going to split it, so it's going to cost you more. I mean, you got a bundle discount, basically.
That makes so much sense now. I wondered why Slack wasn't so much more integrated into Salesforce.
Because they would have to give a discount.
It turns out they were trying to stay within the legal bounds.
Oh, that's what it was.
Yeah, that's what it was. That's why it's so hard to get Slack.
Right. yeah, so an example is new clients of Office 365 E3. What is that? What is E3?
I have no idea. Yeah.
We'll pay $3 more per person per month with the split than they would have for the combined offering. Thanks, regulators, making it actually more expensive.
Okay, you just pass that on to the customer.
So while customers believe Zoom is a superior platform to Teams and other vendors, the bundling of MS Teams into Office 365, easy for me to say, has always been enticing for customers to consider Teams. Some people are opining that this is Microsoft learning from Apple's mistakes.
How?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because I don't quite get that.
I don't either.
Did Apple have to go through some? I mean, I know Apple's they're facing a bunch of regulatory scrutiny, right?
They did for the App Store.
App Store. Yeah.
Maybe that's it. I don't know. I don't see how that. I was thinking about communications, but.
Because I don't think there was an actual ruling that's forcing this. I think it's Microsoft. They see the writing on the wall, and so they're just preempting it.
Maybe. It's probably easier just to kind of split the license than it is to kind of go through a long, drawn-out battle that they know they're going to lose.
It's weird. I still hear such mixed reviews of Teams. Like, you have some people that just say they love it. And then so many people that are just like, this, it's terrible. I hate it. Now, I don't really have an informed opinion. I do have Teams because every once in a while I have to join a Teams call.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have it installed on my machine.
Yeah, me too.
And it's, I always have a problem joining a meeting every single time or like connecting to the right audio or whatever. Maybe that's just because I don't use it very often. So I don't know.
I have that in general. Connecting to the right ear pods.
I never have that problem with Slack ever. Slack will remember what you now. I guess the challenge I throw at these things is like, I've got all these, you know, sometimes I'll have my, sometimes it'll be on my, what do you call them? AirPods.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my audio source. Sometimes I've got my desktop stuff plugged in and it's different USBs. But Slack will remember like kind of what your preference is.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point that like, if I jump on a Slack and I forget that my USB is not plugged in, I'll plug it in and then it immediately switches to what it knows that that's my preferred device. It's pretty good. Yeah. It's actually better than Slack. I've been having a problem with Slack the past few weeks. I'm not sure why. I'll jump in a huddle, you know, the Slack mm-hmm. huddle feature, and no one can hear me. And my audio, I'll go check out my, it's using the right device and everything. It's just like, it's just stopped.
Is that lately?
Yes.
I think it's the Apple issue.
Could be.
I've been having the same issue with WebEx, with Slack, with everything.
Oh, see, I don't have it with anything but Slack.
I have it with Zoom is multiple fine. Devices.
Really?
And it's, I don't know what it is, but some change recently happened. And are you on the latest OS, maybe?
I am, although I think I'm due for the dot update that
yeah,
I haven't installed
yet. I don't
yet.
Think the dot addresses it. But yeah, I wonder if it was some kind of patch that broke the syncing, because I've had a lot more problems lately where I never had problems before with it connecting to AirPods properly. Like, it will say it's connected, but it's not.
Yeah. Well, Bluetooth is, I always tell people at our company, like, do not use Bluetooth audio devices. They just... they're so, even AirPods, which are probably the most reliable because they have that, what's the special chip that is enhances Bluetooth to be way better. If you're staying totally within the Apple ecosystem, switches between your Mac and your iPhone and your iPad, like seamlessly all the time, even though Apple has that, it's still not good enough. And also there is just an inherent latency to these Bluetooth protocols.
Mm-hmm.
And you're, you know, when people are watching you, like your audio video sync is a little bit off. It looks like it's very uncanny valley. I just tell people don't do Bluetooth. Just plug in with an old school headphone jack. I think computers still have those, right?
So far, none of my meetings have been so critical that I can't fiddle with my AirPods for a couple minutes before we start. Mm,
yeah. All right. Your turn, John.
Just trading off.
And now back to John.
Now a word from our sponsor. I think this is a pretty good topic, and it's one that's timely because it's a problem I'm trying to solve right now. This was an article from a friend of the show, or a friend of the community, probably more specifically, Mitch Spano, MitchSpano.com blog. Deploy faster, test smarter, the selective unit test strategy every Salesforce org needs.
Ooh, I like it.
I'm not sure exactly where to start on this, but I'll start with this one paragraph. Sorry, I'm a bit asthmatic today for some reason.
It's okay.
So I've been having to take deep breaths. Unfortunately, the dream of running all unit tests quickly in Salesforce development has historically been hampered by a key factor, tightly coupled tests. Traditionally, Salesforce developers haven't been able to always isolate their unit tests from their org's data, meaning tests rely on interacting with actual Salesforce databases. This heavily reliance significantly inflates test execution time, sometimes ballooning to multiple hours for comprehensive test suites.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I do want to comment on that.
Yeah.
I get what he's saying here, but I don't think you can blame this on developers because, to my knowledge, there is literally no way. You could create a unit test that had nothing but a debugging statement.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it a unit test because that's what Salesforce calls them. But we all know, and what I'm about to say further cements this, these are not unit tests. Because you can create a test with nothing but a debug statement. And when you run it, the first thing Salesforce, I don't say first thing, because I don't know all the details, but one of the things that it does before your test actually runs is it starts a transaction, a database transaction, and essentially deletes all of your data, and except for the stuff. What's the thing now that you can say this is
the run all with all data or something.
See all data. Yeah, unless you do that. It actually starts a transaction, deletes all your data, which is why when in test, you have to then create, like, if your test uses a contact, you have to create that contact in your test because your test has no visibility to contacts because it's in a transaction, which will get rolled back, mm-hmm. but it deletes all your data. And you could have, like I said, you could have a unit test that is purely a unit test. It's really just like, you know, testing interaction between, or just testing functionality of a class that doesn't touch anything in the database. And it doesn't matter. It has to do that. And that test will take 10 to 30 seconds to run. The test that does nothing, that mm-hmm. has a debug statement, will take 10 to 30 seconds to do absolutely nothing. Am I wrong about this?
No, I don't know what the mechanic is. I don't know if it's a delete or what, but I agree. There's some kind of initialization or something that happens during that time that takes a fair amount of time, longer than it would take to run execute the actual code.
Yeah, and it has nothing to do with if you're what Mitch is saying. If you're if you're not following good practices or whatever. I mean, sure, there are dumb things you can do, and I'm sure you know he's right about that with tests. I mean, you can be inefficient, but it doesn't matter how inefficient, it doesn't matter how efficient you are. It's you're going to pay that penalty of it firing up a complete, full blown end to end system/integration test. Right. There's no way to opt out of that.
Right.
So yes, all your simple, well designed, super svelte tests are going to be very, 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 very slow.
Right.
On this platform.
And I mean. And I think he's just setting up the use case of why, because I think for a lot of people who just kind of stumble upon this and aren't Salesforce developers, you might be wondering, well, why is this such an issue? Because in every other environment, you can isolate things well enough and get true unit testing where you can write code and see the test happening as you write code, which I think is what we would all love to have.
Yeah.
So there is a bit of a, and I did this too when I was blogging as well. Spending a fair amount of time in the upfront of the blog of the article to justify why I'm writing about You're this. Right. You know, why is this an issue?
It doesn't seem like this should be an issue, right? But in fact it is.
Yeah. So I think a lot of this would, and in fact, that's pretty much what he does. Let's see. There's probably 1, 2, 3 major sections upfront dedicated to justifying the problem before we get to the moving parts where he specifically says, now that we've established the why behind the need for selective unit testing.
Right, but let's get on to what it's does he explain what is selective unit testing? What does this mean?
I don't know if he specifically defines it. I understood it from reading all this and I don't want to read it to everybody.
Or do you just want to continue? Or just continue like this.
But essentially it's selective unit testing is choosing which tests you want to run. So whenever you're doing a deployment, or in this case, specifically when you're committing a PR to the system, I think is probably one thing that we're struggling with when it comes to DevOps in terms of what do we do. So we have this new bit of code that we want to put into our main branch or whatever, do a commit and merge in. We obviously want to run tests so that we can validate that before that merges, it's valid code and we're not screwing up our source. Mm-hmm. So you want to run tests.
All of them. I'm serious. If you worked on some stuff and you've run all your tests, that's great. Next thing you have to do is pull down all the commits that have been pushed up since you started working and rebase it, right? Mm-hmm. Usually. And now you have yet a unique set of bits, mm-hmm. which you should test. And you don't know, you really don't know what all tests might fail, what areas might have impact. So you kind of got to run all tests. Now, can you try to figure out the subset that were probably just affected? And as long as at some point before a release happens, a full exhaustive test suite runs, can you get away with just running some? Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And maybe that's what Mitch is talking about.
And I think that's what he is. I think the, for lack of a better word, I think the best practice that most of us are moving towards is, in order for us to have a chance at having a continuous delivery system, is that we would have a PR. Whatever is affected by that PR would get tests run immediately, so that we can at least validate on merge that we're not breaking something. But as a failsafe, we would have some kind of nightly or hourly job that would run all tests.
Yeah, nightly is a great option for that. Yep.
So So I think that's kind of what we're,
because they can take, you know, 4 hours plus, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's just the world we live in. That's the card we've been dealt with.
Yep.
So some of the strategies described in this is what he's calling automatic targeting. So automatically executing any test that falls within the scope of the pull request changes. So that involves at the time of your PR that the test class is in your PR and that it would recognize that you have a test class in that PR and it would execute the test for that PR.
Can you run that by me again?
So at the, assuming your tooling supports this, mm-hmm. or you have some automation written to support this, is at the time you merge your PR, when it goes to do that merge, it detects that what's in that merge or that in that PR is test classes okay. that supposedly cover the code that you're merging. And it would find those within that PR and run those tests.
Oh, I think this is a big problem.
Continue.
you can change code. That actually doesn't and not change test classes.
Right.
And what's it going to run? Nothing? I don't think, again, and maybe I should not be too spectrum about this. You know, you don't really know. You don't know what you might have broken. And in fact, the changes you made may not necessitate any new tests. So mm-hmm. How does it know what to test?
Yeah.
How does it know that, you know, maybe some change you made causes some seemingly unrelated trigger to operate in a different way because of what you've done. And that's a whole other area of the code base with different tests. And it's not mm-hmm. going to know to test those. But again, you know, the nightlies will catch those. Maybe that's not that huge of a deal, you know?
Right. Yeah. So I think that's one of those, it's a strategy. It has its pros and cons. And mm-hmm. I think you've articulated those pretty well.
Okay, I'll get off that.
I wasn't cutting you off.
I just want to make my... No, I feel like I'm over making my
point. I think you're going through the thought process as this was written or as these strategies were developed, because the next one is a way to solve for that, which is that there were no changes to the test class, so it's not going to be in the PR. It's not like you can just selectively say, okay, put this class in the PR. It's just not how it works. So the next one is a comment-driven selection, which I think is... not bad. In fact, I might even try this with our system because we are looking for a way to solve for this.
All right.
And trying to automatically write a script that's going to try to figure out what to pull out and what to test is daunting.
Oh, yeah.
So this one, the description of this one is specify an enumerated list of tests to be executed directly within the pull request comment body. So the recommendation on this one is that in your pull request, you can put a comment on your pull request, and in that comment, you would have some kind of nomenclature. In this case, it's like tests equals, and then it's got brackets around it, and you enumerate the list of test classes you want to run.
Okay,
and that way,
you're saying as the person who created this pull request or this set of commits, I think this is a good set of tests to run. You're just telling them
it should be better than that. Okay. As the developer who's working on it, you should have already ran the test. You should already know what tests are going to execute to give you your best chance at coverage. Mm-hmm. So you should already know that list.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So you're saying you put that list of tests.
Like, you put that onus back on the developer or whoever's initiating the PR.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he has a little example of a script that will basically parse that out and match that in and run it, which I think is not a bad way of doing it.
Yeah.
Also, you'll have documentation.
Because that's always super accurate and useful, documentation.
How can I say this? right now, we verbally, because we don't really have a really good way of enforcing it without incurring a lot of people's time or adding another person to the team to do just this. We ask the developer, "Did it pass test? Did you get proper coverage during the code review?" at least with this, we can document what we thought we would check, and we could at least know, you know, if there's a problem downstream, we can go back to some things.
I mean, it all comes back to, you know, we're engineers, and engineering is all it's almost exclusively all about trade-offs. And every platform, every system, every code base, they all have different trade-offs. And mm-hmm. when you're working on the Salesforce platform, you have a certain set of trade-offs, and these are the trade-offs we make.
Right.
Is it perfect? No, but nothing is. That's why it's called trade-offs.
Yeah. And the next one, which I think is kind of a hybrid, almost compromising version of both, or maybe a compromise of between selective and going to just running full tests, which is defining a course, or what is called always on testing, which is defining a core set of tests that will always run regardless of the specific pull request content. That was me. Sorry. Okay. I'm not
Yeah, a core set that will always run, that they're just, for whatever reason, mission critical or like maybe fundamental or for whatever reason.
Yeah. And I think for situations where you, maybe you have a part of your system that is very mission critical and you have proper tests around that for regressions, I think that that blended kind of makes sense. You could do a combination of a comment driven where you're saying, okay, I'm making changes. These are the tests to run. The tests will run. The PR will essentially happen pretty efficiently, which means you're not creating this huge backlog for other developers who are waiting to get their stuff in, into the repo. But for those mission critical ones, you can say, yeah, we're going to run these, but we're always going to also run these. And that way you kind of get a good chance of getting good coverage at the time of merging. Hopefully within a reasonable time frame of execution. Obviously we're at Salesforce's whim on that.
Yep.
Without having to incur the full test run.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of good stuff here. I think it's a great article. I'll put it in the show notes for you guys to read. There's a lot more stuff explored and a lot of examples of how to kind of script it or how to implement it. So it's a good read.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, Mitch, I mean, I suspect from what I know, kind of the stuff he works on, he works on big code bases. And so this is probably a lot of, you know, hard fought wisdom and some kind of conclusions and learnings he's got from that. So I would definitely recommend everyone take a read of that. We'll put it in the show notes, I'm sure, right, John?
Absolutely.
Back to Apple for a minute. Is that allowed? Can we do two Apple conversations in one show, or are we going to get too many complaints or some bad reviews?
No, we're a tech podcast. We're tech journalists.
So Apple may be working on a Rosie the Robot. You know where that's from?
That sounds familiar. Remind me.
The Jetsons. That was the,
oh, that's
the
right.
Robot,
yep,
Rosie.
Yep.
So, you know, they had this, and gosh, I can't imagine. Oh, we didn't really talk about this, but, you know, Apple, they ended their development of their car.
Right.
And I just was, you know, when they did that, I thought, oh my gosh, because I, you know, as a very, very small time Apple shareholder, I'm just like, how much money did we blow on that car? Probably a lot. You know, now, did they create some corporate assets and IP that are very, very valuable and useful in other areas of the business? Sure. Mm-hmm. But I mean, man, how much money did they spend on that program? And I was looking forward to an Apple car.
I don't know that it was that much of a waste, because if you think about it, most of that is software driven. And I mean, Apple, like with Apple TV, that's soft. I mean, it's,
I mean, we know how to make brakes and wheels and suspensions, right? We know this is not very interesting technology.
Yeah. So they learned a lot, and whatever they learned, they could apply into software, like the car kit or whatever it's called. CarPlay.
CarPlay.
They could roll that into CarPlay, and there you go. I mean,
yeah. And honestly, the other thing is, I guess that's why I mentioned IP. Whatever the stuff they developed, they could license out to other, you know, who knows? But anyway, so that's gone. But, you know, I think you're seeing some of what they developed into that program start filtering into these other areas. But this is one of them. So the people are thinking that they're they have a robot program. Mm.
That does seem to be the new hotness.
Okay. Maybe.
There's a lot of companies doing robots.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Some of them are quite scary, too. They've gotten way too good. It's very, what was the movie? What was Terminator? Very not Terminator. What was the movie with the robot cop? RoboCop. Oh, that's great. I got to mark that.
That was good.
Oh, we got a snort out of John.
It's because you guys couldn't see his face when he immediately realized what he said.
That'll have to be our opener. Okay. All right. So this is a Mark Gurman thing. He's the, you know, the supposed Apple insider. He says Apple is exploring, and I didn't read his previous article. He links to that. He said Apple is exploring the idea of making personal robotic devices suffused with artificial intelligence, not infused, suffused. Now, John,
why are they trying to give us
this? Is
words?
A new word for me. This is a new word for me. I have to let's look this up. Oh, diffusion. I look it up and it says diffusion, but he says suffused. Anyway, the company has Skunkworks teams within its hardware engineering and AI organizations delving into robotics. One recent project involved a home robot that could follow a person around the home. Some involved in the effort have even postulated that Apple could get into humanoid technology. And that's Rosie. What was the show that came on Saturday mornings with the girl, the guy had the little sister that was a robot?
Oh, I don't remember the name, but I remember it. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Some involved in the effort have even postulated that Apple could get into a humanoid technology and build a machine that can handle household chores. But such advances are probably a decade away, and it doesn't appear that Apple's even agreed to head in that direction. A nearer term move into robotics would be a device Apple has been working on for several years.
Sorry, I got excited.
You're touching it again, John. A tabletop product that uses a robotic arm to move around the display. Okay. The arm could be used to mimic a human on the other side of a FaceTime call, shifting the screen to recreate a nod or a shake of the head. That just seems super, super lame to me. But this device, too, doesn't have any unified support from Apple's executive team.
Well, if they ever made it happen, it would be a small wonder.
It's weird. This was kind of a downer of an article because he's like, Apple could be working on humanoids. But then, and then he's like, but actually, there's no support from the management team for this, and they're probably not doing it. Yeah. But then he goes on to talk about iPads. So 2024, just to have a small Apple segment here, is shaping up to be the year of the iPad. I know you're an iPad guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, people are, he says, have been eagerly waiting for an upgraded tablet. On the docket is the revamped iPad Pro, which is apparently very stale right now.
It is.
In the last major update, 2018.
And whatever small incrementals, there's just not much value.
Processor bumps and...
There's not much value for dollar to switch out your old iPad, your old Pro for a new Pro.
Right. No, I'm sure if you have a 2018 iPad Pro, it's probably just fine.
Yeah.
I mean, does it need an update? Yes. But are you going to buy a brand new iPad Pro just to get a processor bump? No.
Yeah.
Anyway, so on the dock is revamped iPad Pro, an iPad Air, a fresh Magic Keyboard. I'm going to ask you about Magic Keyboards. I don't know anything about them. And an Apple Pencil. Altogether, this launch is shaping up to be one of the biggest updates to the Apple tablet in a single day. And it's a long time coming, especially for the iPad Pro, which hasn't had a meaningful refresh since 2018. Thoughts from John on a big iPad year?
I don't think it'll translate to much, to be honest.
I do. I have an iPad mini, and I take it when I travel, because that's what I watch TV shows and movies on airplanes. And I've also, I know you're not supposed to do this, but I will, like last night, I was super tired. Wasn't ready quite to go to sleep, but I wanted to watch like a little bit of TV. So I just had my iPad in my bed. Watched a little bit of TV. But I also read. That's what I, on my Kindle. I don't have a Kindle. It's my iPad, Kindle app.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much all I use an iPad for. I've never had a big iPad-shaped, you know, problem in my life.
I think for people who want to have portable entertainment devices, I think that's where its niche is. So the Pro market, I think, is an even smaller niche than that. When you segment out the iPad market, so that's where I think the pros is a bit difficult to say.
Yeah,
unless they come out with something that makes it a true Mac AirBook competitor, that's the only thing that would change that story.
And they're talking about that, how this next iOS is going to be a big update.
Mm-hmm.
He also talks about Mark Gurman. I think this article talks about how Do you remember this time? This is probably 10 years ago now. But when people were like, they made it their mission, even software engineers.
Yeah.
To go completely tablet. Like they had their terminal, their everything, you know, external keyboard, mouse, all this stuff. They were going to go. And people did it. I saw them try it for the iPad. And then there was some podcast I used to listen to. Oh, it was one of the Chris Coyer, the ones, the CSS Tricks guy. What was their show called? I think it was that show. I don't listen to it anymore.
I don't listen to it anymore either.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll think of it in a minute. But his co-host, he did a year-long thing using I think it was a Surface tablet. And he was a Mac guy, switched to the Surface. He was like, I'm going to he's a web developer, but he was a, you know, also a serious developer. I mean, super good at JavaScript and CSS and all kinds of stuff. And ultimately, everyone abandons these.
Mm-hmm.
It just is not, it's not there.
Well, it's not there. And well, he went the Surface route, so he should have had a better chance at it. With iPads, it's a little bit more difficult because it is
shop talk.
There you go.
That Sorry.
Was it. Okay. Yeah. It was, it's a bit of a walled garden with iPads, because it's not like you can install your favorite tool off the shelf or anything like that. They have to have something in the App Store for it, or you could jailbreak your iPad. But so iPads are a bit more difficult to kind of accomplish that. But if you went the Surface route and still abandoned it, that says something too.
Yeah, because Surface, they probably give you full control. It's Microsoft, right? Yeah. So they, you know. Yeah.
So anyway, since you missed it when I said it, it's a small wonder.
Oh, small wonder. Yes, we both had brain things at the same time.
Character's name was Vicky. Wonder.
Vicky.
Yeah.
That's, Vicky is not an appropriate name for a...
They even gave her a maid outfit to wear.
Oh, it was kind of weird. Kind of creepy.
It was creepy.
Yeah. This is probably maybe the most interesting thing. For the first time, Apple will be moving its they say tablet screens. Why am I not saying iPad? They'll be moving their tablet screens to OLED. Now, iPhones already use OLED.
Mm-hmm. They do?
Yep.
Mine's OLED?
It should be.
Cool.
But, you know, iPads, I noticed on iPad, it's, you see, what's it called? Bloom. You see Bloom? Because it's just backlit. And there's probably a lot of LEDs back there, but it's still just an array of LEDs. It's not like every pixel is... I mean, the pixels are not, what's the word? They're not emissive. Mm-hmm. They're passive. So you have to have light behind it that shines through the pixel.
Right.
And there's only, let's call it 128 of those lights back there. And so, sure, it turns them on and off. But if you just have some small dot, like bright dot on a black screen that's moving around, you're going to see all kinds of blooming.
Right. Yeah.
Now, do I want to pay $100 or $200 more for my next iPad mini to get OLED? It's not for me necessarily. I don't think I'll have a choice. They're all going to be OLED, but.
Well, I mean, if you're in the market for one, then it's a great feature to have.
And for like really serious artists and stuff, it's probably pretty important. I mean, cause you want to see exactly what you're working on and not, artifacts of the display technology.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I just don't know how mission critical iPads are to the artist community, since they've got so many other tooling.
I don't either. I mean, artists are an interesting bug.
Oh, wait a minute. Artists, AI.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We don't need artists anymore.
Yeah, right. No, artists are an interesting bunch. I mean, they all have such different idiosyncrasies and different workflows and stuff. And some of them have really adopted the kind of tablet workflow, and some of them are way more analog, and some of them are still using the what are the tablets?
Wacom.
Yeah, Wacoms or whatever. Whack'em. Yeah.
Whack'em.
Whack'em if you got them.
But those have so many features. I mean, in terms of pressure sensitivity and all that kind of stuff that really cater to that. And I think the pencils try to, but I don't know what the feedback is from the community on.
Yeah.
I used to watch this guy, Brad Kobo. I used to read his blog, and then when he started doing YouTube videos, I watched his stuff, and he did a lot of eval with different tablets on how good they were for drawing and things like that.
Hmm. Cool.
But I haven't recently. So,
last thing on this, I think, is that Apple is exploring the prospect of foldable iPads.
I'm not big on the foldable market. I'm not either,
but if they can get it right, I would be interested. It's just, especially considering that my main use case for iPad is travel. But even then, I put it in my.
It's thin for a reason. You want it thin for, so why are you going to fold it and make it thicker?
I don't know. That's a good question. To me, it's a non problem. Like you are solving a non problem.
I mean, at least for phones, you can say you want to fit it in your pocket. Better.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Even then, I'd rather have a thin phone than a big bulky one.
I know.
You know.
Yeah. But they're very non-committal to it, so don't worry about it. All right. Well, that's my iPad segment, John.
I don't think that's all I have, too. Unless you want to.
I've got more stuff. I also have more beer. And you're very behind, so you better start chugging.
I'm curious, and maybe you can answer this for me, what this faux heated competition thing is going on between Shopify and Salesforce.
Oh, I have that. I have that. Let's talk about that.
Because I think I can segment that into some of the things I'm working on, or not working on, but we've been discussing as a company internally, and how I think it's bad for Salesforce. Jeremy's trying to turn us into an ASMR podcast.
I am.
I say ASMR because I know what it refers to, but I forgot what the acronym means.
Oh, I did too. No one knows what it means. Oh, I need a tissue. Hang on. Okay. Let's jump to that, actually. So this started with Shopify has poached at least 24 employees from Salesforce. I'm trying to think if there's anything interesting about that. But the thing I thought was funny was, I then got linked into Shopify's, you know, page that's Shopify versus Salesforce Commerce Cloud,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of interesting. Good looking page. Really well laid out, man. They're what is that called? Information architecture, how stuff's laid out just psychologically. It's so clean and like they're great at that. They're great at this.
The Shopify is.
Yeah. Let me just show you the link so you can play along with me. Yeah. And they say in 2023, a big three consulting company, who probably charged them $850 an hour to do this, released a study of e-commerce conversion rates and found Shopify's conversion checkout conversions to be 36% better than Salesforce's. That's because Shopify has carefully engineered its checkout for throughput, speed, conversion, personality, familiarity, and extensibility. I have to say, I've said this before, not even thinking about, I always forget about Salesforce Commerce Cloud. I mean, I never see it. Whereas I feel like every site that I use that uses Shopify for checkout, even if it doesn't say Shopify, Shopify knows me, mm-hmm. and I'm set up with it, and it makes checking out honestly dangerously easy. And it's so well done. It's so well engineered. The UI is so free. The UX is so perfect. It's just too easy.
Yeah.
It's not good for my bank account. and that's what they're talking about. You know, the Shopify has been in the news. There's some other stuff, just maybe this more in the kind of the developer community. Can't remember where I saw this, but they get a lot of credit for just being such an excellent place to work.
Mm.
And I think that's, you know, and this is the, you know, the, despite all the AI stuff and everyone laying everyone off, like because these companies still really compete for the A players. Right. And it's hard to keep A players. It's not just about money, you know. I mean, obviously money's important, but and these A players, I mean, they're the ones who can get you into that top position of and I don't know who's, I'm not saying that Shopify's checkout rate is better than Salesforce's because I don't know. Salesforce Marketing Cloud, I don't think is ever visible to me. And maybe that is a feather in Salesforce's cap.
That
I don't even know who it is. It's just, you know, it's so well like white labeled or whatever that I can't even tell. Whereas I can always tell when it's Shopify. Always. Or I feel like I usually can. Now, I will say maybe that's because a lot of these smaller-ish retailers, like not multi-billion dollar, what do they call them? Multi-country. What's the word? International. Anyway, this giant, you know, global corporations. They probably have, you know, they have the money to have absolutely completely custom UI and UX experience, and they're using their commerce vendor via its APIs.
Right.
Whereas a lot of these shops, like there's some wine places I buy from, all kinds of little smaller, you know, these companies are probably less than $30 million in revenue. That they're just, they kind of like, they have the approach of, once you get to the checkout or the cart or whatever, like it kind of just Shopify kind of takes over.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you can put your logo on the top of the screen or whatever, but it's really just, you can tell it's a Shopify screen.
Yeah.
So maybe that looks a little less professional, less polished or whatever, but Shopify does such a good job of it. And I see that. I mean, I see that it's Shopify. Which, another thing about that, that always, maybe this is a benefit of keeping it simple and just using your commerce vendor screens. Immediate comfort for me. Mm-hmm. Immediate comfort and safety. Yep. I know that I'm not getting my credit card stolen. I know that they have my shipping address. They've got my payment cards already. Everything's smooth and easy.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'm on, you know, if I go to some big clothing retailer set that I've never bought from before or whatever, and it's some completely custom, you know, and I have to set up a new account with them and I have to put my credit card in because they don't share that across, you know, whatever. Whereas Shopify, it seems like I can go buy from someone I never bought before. And if it's Shopify, Shopify's got all my stuff. Mm-hmm. They have my credit card. They have my address. They have all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Commerce Cloud has that model or not, or if it's optional. I really don't know. But anyway,
I think PayPal does that as well. I mean, does that well for me.
Oh yeah. I don't know.
I see more PayPal than I see Shopify, but I don't do a lot of online shopping, but I will commensurate that. I get that same reaction when I see the PayPal button, I click it because I feel more secure.
Really?
Yeah. I like seeing the PayPal UI.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't ever use PayPal. I don't know why. Now, when you use PayPal, do you have a PayPal balance, or is PayPal just pulling from your checking account when you?
It's just pulling from.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you know, they.
I don't give PayPal access to my. I mean, it has access to my bank account, but it goes to the credit card. Sorry.
Really? Goes to your credit card? Okay. Yeah, it's certainly not a good idea to give things access to your bank account. That's just,
well, you have to for fund transfers and things like that. But
yeah, you're right.
But for purchasing, I have it linked to the credit card.
But yeah, then you go to, and then let me open up Salesforce's. Let's see, I'll shoot you this link.
That's my walled garden.
Yeah. And Salesforce has a similar page. They've got, you know, why Salesforce over Shopify. Here's some of the brands. Now, they just have three, whereas Shopify has like this scrolling list of all these brands. But they have some metrics and like these little cards here, which looks pretty good. What sets Commerce Cloud apart? Salesforce is just more wordy. I don't know. I don't know. I got to say, just from the page, this comparison page alone, I think Shopify takes the cake on this one.
Yeah, I don't know too much about Commerce Cloud in general.
Well, I think what's creating this, what, you know, this kind of battle is started between Shopify and Salesforce is that Shopify, so I guess Commerce Cloud, who was it that company they bought? Do you remember? I forget the name of it. It's not top of my head. But that company was, from I think its inception, targeting the big enterprise space. That's where they played. Whereas Shopify started on the small end.
Mm-hmm.
And they've grown and grown and grown and grown and grown and grown and grown. And they really are now moving into enterprise. So now they're starting to, you know, come up against Salesforce in deals.
And that makes sense.
You're seeing this battle now, but
yeah,
this is fun.
It is. But I think.
Of course, Salesforce, you know, on their comparison page, you know, it's all this trailhead looking stuff, all this forest looking stuff. There's a big Einstein thing. And I just wonder, like, sure, for those of us and all these photos of, I don't know if these are real people, but they're all wearing their Trailblazer hoodies. And it's like, you know, if you're some random business that's trying to choose between Shopify and Salesforce and you come to this Salesforce page, you're like, what world did I just get into here?
Yeah.
What is this? What are these stuffed animals and all this? Am I in a forest? Is this from the Forest Service? What is this?
Well, I think I agree, but I think at this point everyone knows Salesforce's culture.
And maybe they do.
They know their branding,
right?
To the point where it just looks normal.
Well, that's what I say. To me, it looks normal. Yeah. Like, it doesn't bother me at all. But I just wonder if I'm in charge of marketing for Salesforce, like, is this, does everything have to be trailhead? Is literally everything? And is that the most optimal thing for our big sales and conversion and like in comparison pages?
I don't think so. I think it's starting to get to be too big of a beast at this point.
the whole trail thing,
the whole trail thing, the forest thing, the modules themselves. Well, there's so many of them.
But on the other hand, is it not just a hugely successful campaign and asset that they have? Why would you not continue to like drive that home and take it? You've built up so much recognition on that. It's just, it is the brand almost nowadays.
Yeah.
Why would you have some vanilla page that didn't have that? It doesn't make any sense.
I agree.
You see, I'm arguing both sides here.
I do, but I mean, I could see both sides too. But I like the imagery. I like the color scheme, the contrast, and everything else. I think it makes it readable. But you're also not getting a lot of information from these screens. You're getting a lot of buzzwords. You're getting a lot of space dedicated to imagery than content. So it very much reads like a standard landing page for a company.
Yeah.
It's not giving you much.
Yeah. Yeah.
For someone who's trying to make a decision between the tools, hopefully they're delving deeper and doing their due diligence. But
right.
I mean, I think the pages themselves serve their purposes.
You know, so I need a counter. But Salesforce, you know, they are Gartner's biggest customer. But you know, they have their Gartner or Salesforce as a leader in the 2023. That's a year old now. Gartner Magic Quadrant for Digital Commerce for the eighth year in a row. They say they're a leader. I wonder where I'm not gonna fill out the lead form to figure out to see the chart to see where Shopify is on that one. Because I will absolutely get a ton of phone calls and texts and emails immediately.
Yeah.
Even though surely, because and every time I do that, I tell them, listen, I'm already in your database. And I've already said, don't call me for this. Aren't you the world's largest CRM? Aren't you a customer company? Why are you doing this? I'm not going to buy it.
Selective memory.
I'm doing podcast research.
No, they don't want to be on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do get those. I ignore them. I used to respond to them, and then I thought, I don't need to respond.
Well, John, I have a. Maybe we can.
Oh, I wanted to tangent off that.
Okay, all
right. Because I think with some of these smaller tools, what their advantages and kind of what Salesforce's advantage was way back when they were starting was that they had these really great APIs. They had good developer documentation. They were very keen.
Still do.
Okay.
You don't think so?
I'm starting to lean towards the other way on that.
On APIs or documentation?
Documentation.
I mean, it's not perfect, and it's such a constantly moving target for the docs team and everything. But
it's not a neg on the department. It's just that there's so much information that it's not effectively organized in a way that I can consume. I have to rely on Google,
which gives
me five different blog sites before I get to Salesforce's content. It's just and when I do get to Salesforce's content, a lot of it seems fluff. Before I get to real content.
Okay. And this is where I think Salesforce is missing the mark right now is they screwed up their search engine ranking.
Mm-hmm.
And they're now putting stuff behind login walls, which is a...
Yes. That annoys me too.
Not just an annoyance. It's a massive problem.
It is a big problem. I will 100%. That has been a big problem for me. I click on something. I read it for a second. And then the stupid login thing comes up. For the trailhead.
Oh, it actually lets you view it for a second?
I've been able to see it for like a second.
Well, maybe you should just disable JavaScript. Can you do that? Or will not work at all?
I'll break the web.
Yeah. Well, no, just for that site. Like I use Brave and I can disable JavaScript just for a certain page or whatever.
Yes. But yeah, it's annoying. I can't get to the content without having to log in and that's not even my problem. I can get logged in. That's fine.
Okay.
It's SSO. It's all easy.
No, but I do wonder though, if it's behind login walls, like can Google see it? And maybe, and even if Google can't see, cause I'm sure they're looking at the user agent. And when they see it's the Google bot, they probably display the content. They serve the content to Google so it can index it and everything. But I still wonder, I mean, Google's smart. I still feel like they know somehow that it, even though you're showing Google that content, like it's still login walled.
Hmm.
Because you're right. It's just gone down to the rankings. Like you have to, it takes a while. You used to be able to just Google whatever you were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And Salesforce's content would come up there because it's the most authoritative content. It should be the first, certainly on the first page, but it should be the first in the list.
Yeah.
And it used to be.
Yeah. And nothing against anyone who's writing blog posts, but we've had a flurry of copycatters. I don't know what you call them, but they basically copy
the
Salesforce blog word for word and paste it into their own blog site.
Well, Google's supposed to be good at preventing that. They can detecting that and then completely basically banning those sites that do that. It's supposed to be banned.
I hope so, because it's a problem.
It is a huge problem. I mean, it always has been. And Google, that's what, you know, that's supposedly what Google is good at. It's figuring that stuff out.
And then, man, this is turning into a blog rant, but like even some of the old school Salesforce specific blog sites that I used to frequent a lot, like Salesforce Ben and all that kind of stuff, those have gotten unusable because now they've filled with so many freaking ads everywhere. It's just not usable. It's
Because they're multi-million dollar companies now they're serving their ad masters.
No, I guess. I mean,
it's their revenue. It's tough. It's tough. I wouldn't want to be in an ad driven business, but I get it. I mean, I get the situation they're in.
Yeah.
That's how they make payroll.
Well, it stopped me from reading.
I know it
maybe
does.
Maybe they got my click and that's all they want is my click, but I'm not reading. I'm not staying on the site. Yeah. And if they've got metrics that are geared on whether or not I'm staying on the site, then it should go down. Oh, they
do. Yeah. So you can contribute to what's called their bounce rate.
Yeah. So what was I saying before? Oh, the whole reason I want to get on this topic is because I think let's talk communities for a second. And one of the reasons that I'm having trouble and we're doing some POCs internally on getting away from Salesforce. And it has everything to do with the developer experience of deployment. It's taken us hours and hours to deploy and validate our sites because we have a combination of things that are in static resources. We have a combination of things that are Lightning components. We have a combination of things that are in this experience bundle that you have to deploy and hope you do right, or it might mess up. And then we've got international to deal with. So we've got language things to validate and everything else. So we have this huge thing to validate. There's no good way of automating that testing. There's no good way of deploying it, first of all.
Yeah.
So it's a very manual, intensive process to the point where the business is like, we should start thinking about moving off this.
Yeah.
And I know Salesforce likes to sell the no code, the no developer type thing, but the tooling themselves aren't even portable enough between environments.
It has nothing to do with even code. This has nothing to do with code.
Yeah.
No, because it's all code. Well, and not to go down that.
It's metadata.
Which is code. And flow boils down to code, and it's all code. It's just some different types of code, but it's all code. It's all metadata, right?
I mean, even with, I'm not trying to say too much.
Okay.
To expose our,
don't get yourself in trouble.
Our architecture.
Yep.
But even in certain instances, we're looking for ways to mitigate our interactions with Salesforce, not only because of the development cycle, but also for performance reasons. The one key advantage that we will give Salesforce, and it's something we're going to try to work with as best we can, is the security model. We really enjoy the security model. It is a pain in the a with when it comes to external users and access to certain types of data.
Pain in the arm. Yep.
But we at least know that we have a user. It's going into the API with that context, and we know we're not exposing data.
Yep.
So we're really happy with that part in terms of security. So we're trying to find ways to not be on the Salesforce community site and provide much more performant experience for our customers, but also ease the burden on our developers and our DevOps team to try to get this out the door, and our QA team who has to validate a ton of stuff with every release.
Mm-hmm.
With trying to get that secure model. It's one thing that I don't know why they don't invest more time in. It's like they tried with DevOps Center, but then where is it? And it hasn't done anything to really affect the community that I can see. It's tied to GitHub.
Yeah.
And I don't even use GitHub, so I can't even use it.
The DevOps Center. Yeah. I mean, they've been saying for a while they're working on some of the other ones. I don't know where they're at on that.
But even if it did, the coverage of the metadata is not there.
Yeah.
In so many ways.
Well, I think one thing you and I agree on is that I feel like Salesforce is definitely at the point, this is a limiting factor for them. And this is nothing that you can put on a fancy marketing page like we were just talking about.
Right.
It doesn't sell well. It's not going to do anything for your stock price.
Right.
It's just a core low-level fundamental thing that is causing customers to be wading through quicksand. And it's a problem. I mean, to me, it's become a real business problem for Salesforce.
It has. Yeah.
And again, you know, gotta give credit. They've done stuff. They've done stuff to improve this some. They've increased metadata coverage. They've fixed a lot of metadata stuff. We've got, you know, again, the whole CLI. I mean, there's, it's just, you know, it's not enough. We need more.
It's not that it's not enough. It's that the fundamental core that it's all built on is extremely broken. So all we're doing is trying to fill the gaps where we can.
Yeah. And I don't, you know,
it's a race to the bottom.
You know,
isn't
let's play the game where John is appointed, you know, director of fixing this. Like this is
John wouldn't take that job.
Exactly. It's an incredibly difficult job because Salesforce is so big. And, you know, I've talked to people who work on the metadata API in the past, and, you know, they're subject to every different product team out there because every different product team is responsible for implementing their part of the metadata API. And it's just, you know, where do you even start? Where do you start? I mean, do you try to reboot this thing? Because huge chance of failure on that.
Yeah.
That's the problem with that.
Yeah.
Like to completely change the model of how this all works.
And what is even the right model? I mean, proprietary at the time might have been the right choice, but is it anymore?
You know, the thing is, again, Salesforce kind of they're a little bit unique in that it's not just the code you're deploying. You're deploying the data model. What would be like, you know, all your tables, your database tables and everything. It's all mixed into one thing.
Yeah. I think decoupling that is probably one of the first key things to do.
But the problem is, I don't see how you could decouple because it's all integrated into, you know, the security model and everything else. And I mean, Salesforce can't have you separately, like deploying your data, like your, can have you running like database migrations. Like that's how you would do it in a non kind of managed system like Salesforce is. Like, you know, when you run deployments, your deployment will, one of the things it does in the deployment process is it will go to your databases and run all the migrations to modify, you know, add tables, merge tables, add fields, you know, all this kind of stuff. And migrate that data model. Cause sometimes, you know, if you're splitting a table into three tables because you're normalizing it more or whatever, like, you know, yeah, you create the two new tables, but then you have to have all the DML statements that moves the existing data around to this new data model. But the database doesn't, in those models though, right? In that model of software deployment, your database does not give a crap about what your code expects. So you can, database is happy as long as your DDL and DML is correct to take all that stuff, not knowing whether your application code is properly using all that. And it's not referencing old stuff or whatever. And Salesforce has to manage all of that. So I don't know if it can be a decoupled model.
Well, yeah, because it's not as simple as having a single table for anything because there's not a single table for anything.
Yeah.
It's all one big table.
No, I don't know. I mean, you know what, however that's implemented, I'm not sure it's one big, I don't think it's one big table.
Big table, but if you distilled it down to its core tenet of what it is, I mean, it's one table with multi-org IDs in it.
Right. And then the question is like our custom objects, you know, when you create a new custom object in Salesforce doesn't create a new table.
No, it doesn't create a new table. Yeah.
Right.
That's what I mean.
So you're basically right. Fundamentally, I think with that, I don't know, man, it's Salesforce is really big. They have a lot of products.
I can't believe
it's kind of a unique model.
I can't believe they did it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I remember our old friend, Mike Fox, proposed a similar idea to me. of a single table. Yeah. And I thought he was crazy as hell.
He was.
And it wouldn't work. And it required so much software level layers at the top of it to manage it all. And I wasn't that good of a developer I was a very bad developer back then.
And that's what Salesforce is doing. That's what they're managing.
Yeah. And I thought the idea was crazy then. I can't believe that's what Salesforce did. And it is where it is today. I mean, they got it to work. I mean, that's an achievement, a huge achievement, because I couldn't fathom how to get that to work.
But I think one problem, like a fundamental problem with the whole deployment system, is that it is effectively pretty declarative. Now they still have like the pre and post something.
The deployment.
So in your deployment package, you can have a pre and a post.
Mm-hmm.
And because this is a problem, you can have a whole set of changes that you've worked through, and now you're deploying this big ball, this new set of bits. And so often the problem is there's no way to specify how you get, because again, the set of bits it's your application code, it's your metadata, it's your data structure, it's your tables, your fields, everything. There's no way to specify how do you get from the old set of bits to the new set of bits.
Yeah, it's almost like you need a.
That's the problem.
It's almost like you need a full transaction list of every change ever made.
Yes,
and that's what you deploy, because that's how databases work.
But it would have to be imperative. And again, I think that's the only right way. Again,
it's a replication.
We serve at this altar of the declarative gods, which is such a dead end fallacy.
Yeah.
And you know, I love what's it? Is it Goetz's law? Every declarative language eventually becomes a terrible imperative language, something like that. I forget what it is. Mm. But you can't solve this problem with a declarative system. Meaning, here I'm declaring this is my set of bits, and I want to throw it at this system, and you make it happen. It doesn't know how to get from point A to point B. So that's why people have to do things like break things up in a really, because this is always, I mean, this has been my advice. I learned this lesson 15 years ago. Do your Salesforce deployments very frequently. You want small change sets, and I'm not using the change sets in terms of the product, just your deployments, what they change should be as small as possible, and do them frequently, because the system, Salesforce simply doesn't know how to go from point A to point B. And the shorter distance is from point A to point B, the higher your chances of success. But oftentimes what you have to do is when you go from point A to point B, then you have to then run some scripts. Mm-hmm. Because again, if you've changed your data model somewhat, you are then now, and this is outside of the deployment transaction, then you are on your own. But here's the problem, you're in production now, but you haven't had a chance. There's a time delay between when you're deployed and then we can actually run like maybe your SQL scripts or whatever that are transitioning you from the old data model to the new.
Yes.
And this is just.
But you also, in that paradigm, you also have the advantage of the database. Well, I mean, you have stored procedures and databases, but typically we're not programming at that level. You have the option of modifying the data and putting it into a state without incurring all the other transactions that would happen in Salesforce, like triggers and flows and all that
yes.
kind of stuff.
Yes.
When we migrate data, we're executing all those things because there's no one way to switch it all off.
No, and really the right way to do it is to, I think this gets hard with Salesforce, but deploy some application code first that works with the existing data model and also the future data model. Mm-hmm. So your application code needs to be forwards compatible and backwards compatible.
Yeah. That's why we've introduced the feature flag system,
but again,
because we need a way to do that.
But you can't do that with Salesforce unless you're doing all dynamic SQL, basically. And there's all kinds of ways where that doesn't work as well. You just can't do these things.
Like what we're planning on doing is feature flagging, which means you can change the logic, but the field still has to be there. Because if someone's using the new logic that has a dependency in that field, it has to exist.
But this whole conversation, I have to say, it goes back to like, you know, you were having this conversation because we work on Salesforce every day. We built our careers around it. We're big Salesforce fans. We want it to get better. We want Salesforce to succeed. And these are the things we think they need to address in order for Salesforce to be able to really be a serious player in this space. And what is this space I'm talking about? It's the space of true enterprise level applications.
Yeah. Well, I'll add to that and say that it's from our perspective, from being a customer, because I'm a customer company.
Of course you are. We all are, right?
No, I mean, I'm a customer. I'm not a consultant anymore. Yeah. I'm not implementing. Yeah. Okay. Some of our decision-making around, you know, our ability to kind of deploy and do things. These things that Salesforce, that these problems that we're talking about has an impact on us to the point where we're thinking about moving off.
Well,
or to not move off Salesforce, obviously, because we're kind of tied in, but changing the way we architect things so that we can avoid Salesforce.
And we don't want to. We don't want to have to do that.
Right.
I don't want to have to. I don't want to have those conversations like, okay, how do we get stuff off of Salesforce because it's become too
right.
We've hit some limit.
Right.
I don't want to have to do that.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have that conversation with, you know, my coworkers, my clients, you know, I'd rather just be like, hey, this is great. We can just keep going on the Salesforce platform.
Yeah. Cause I mean, even for us, I mean, there's only a finite number of resources to go around. And I mean that in the broadest sense, people, technology, hardware, all of the above, all of the resources. So when we have to say Salesforce is causing us enough issues that we think we need to do something outside of it, that's taking people off the Salesforce team and onto this other team.
And it's just a bummer because it's not the vision of Salesforce. It's not the story of Salesforce. We shouldn't be faced with this.
Right. I mean, it would almost be better if Salesforce was more restrictive to the point where we can predict what's going to happen. I mean, there's so much unpredictability around our ability to deliver solutions on the platform that it's almost easier to say, I can either write a JavaScript or I have to write this external application that's going to do it.
Yeah.
That was the world we started in, you and I. It was workflow and everything else we wrote, hand wrote.
Yeah.
And that model, it was better. It required the client to host
our application. It was more predictable. Certainly more predictable, right?
But it was far more predictable. Yeah. We had a clean API. We knew what to expect from that API.
You weren't working late on Friday nights trying to debug deployments that failed.
Yeah, exactly. No, ours are in the middle of the week.
Well, that's good, at least.
No, because you work all day and then you work all night. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
you think about a system where all you have is maybe a little bit of scripting or maybe even some point and click workflow tool. You get to as far as you can with that. Everything else is outside of that. And now you're into the world of standard development. And you have all the tooling, all the experience, all the shared knowledge of that to lean on.
Yeah.
Is it cheaper? We were told that was expensive. Should just keep it on the platform, but I'm starting to wonder. I don't think that's any cheaper or more expensive.
Yeah, I mean, cost is always such a tricky thing because, you know, there's what you're paying for licenses and subscriptions, but then there's so many other costs. It's like the whole total cost of ownership conversation.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more that goes into it than just checks you're writing to vendors.
Yeah.
Anyway, we probably beat that one up. Salesforce is strengthening MuleSoft with AI tools to extract data and automate workflows. Nice little VentureBeat article.
Oh, that's because they did a flurry last week of AI. So they did one for MuleSoft and they did one for Tableau.
Yeah. I mean, AI is Salesforce's. This is kind of the narrative amongst the media I noticed recently is that Salesforce is trying to reinvent itself with AI. Good opportunity to. They need it. I mean, it's just. It's a good springboard. And I think there's a lot of credibility that out there that's saying that they're going to be able to do this. I think, again, you know, it's funny. I've said that, like, most of these players in the AI space aren't going to make money. There's a few exceptions.
General purpose.
NVIDIA is going to make money. And then the end application providers are going to make money. the ones that really figure out how to leverage AI to make their solutions more valuable. Everyone in between, all these LLM vendors and the open AIs and all this stuff, none of them are going to make any money. No one's making any money, and they're not going to. Uh-uh. There's no business model there. It's a race to the bottom.
It's the same problem that all of those low code general purpose applications vendors had, basically access databases in the cloud.
Yeah,
it was the same problem they had. There were two general purpose. They didn't do anything specific. And a lot of companies, they're looking for quick turnkey solutions. They want to know that they're going to buy something that understands their data model, understands their industry, and that they're going to be able to implement it and have some success at it, not build it from ground up. Because if they're going to build it from ground up, then why not just do it ourselves?
Yeah. I mean, when you look at Salesforce and their opportunities here, I mean, like a salesperson, like just tell me what deals to focus on. Service. Give me the chatbots. Give me the service is such an obvious strong point for AI. There's so much opportunity there for Salesforce to by multiples increase the value of their solution.
Mm-hmm.
For developers. And when I say developers, I mean, because it's all code. So whether you're writing angle brackets, whether you're doing flows, whatever, it doesn't matter. You're all mm-hmm. developers. We're all developers, right, John? There's so much opportunity there for AI as well. There's a lot of this is a great opportunity for Salesforce to reinvent itself, because they're on that one of those tiers that there is opportunity to create value.
Yes,
you're either NVIDIA or you're where Salesforce is. Everything in between, don't invest in that. And note, we are not financial advisors. This is not financial advice. Whatever those, safe harbor. Don't listen to us. We're not lawyers. We're not certified FINRA analysts or whatever.
I don't know where I saw this, but that reminded me. I think Johnny Ive is doing a new startup with someone from OpenAI.
Oh, well, Johnny
Ive. Sam Altman, yeah.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Is he really? Well, Sam Altman's still busy at OpenAI. Is that where Johnny Ive is now?
It says OpenAI CEO Sam Altman and former Apple designer chief Johnny Ive have officially teamed up to design an AI-powered personal device and are seeking funding.
Well, okay, so I think Sam Altman has realized that the space he's in is not going to make money.
Yeah. I love Johnny Ive's stuff, but the practicality of a lot of his designs, you know, they leave some gaps there.
Yeah, he smoked a little bit too much of his own crack, I think.
Yeah. So I'm curious. But in some ways, he holds that principle. Kind of like, what's his name, that did a human interface book?
Raskin. Yeah.
He was very dogmatic about his perspective on UA design. And to a certain extent, I understand that, but it wasn't practical. I mean, there's a reason we're humans. We can multitask.
Principles there, though. You know,
there's a lot of good principles there. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, there were things about it that were just, they weren't practical, and they didn't really allow for flexibility in design and usability that would be creative.
Yeah.
For advanced users.
Yeah. Makes sense. Couple just throwaway things and we close up. Gmail's 20 years old.
Oh, wow. Do you remember getting your first invite?
I do.
Did you have to ask? Beg someone for it?
I got some invite from someone, I'm sure.
I think I had to go around asking a few people for it. Like, you got an invite?
Send me an invite. I remember the big thing was was it 5 gig or 15 gig of storage you got for free? But of course, now I pay Google. I don't know how much it is, even for my personal account, because I have like a terabyte of emails or something like that. And so I have to pay them. And I remember thinking like the 15 gig, that was insane, because most email providers at the time, like you had like 15, maybe 50 megabytes of free storage. And Gmail's like, hey, we'll give you just like effectively endless. You know, you logged into your new Gmail account, had 15 gig of free, and like, you know, it showed you like of 100% of storage, you're using 0.62% of your storage. And now I'm at a terabyte somehow. I still get a ton of spam. The interface is god awful.
Yes.
It's god awful. Now, I know the keyboard shortcuts really well. Like, I have so much muscle memory around Gmail.
I like using
the
client.
I went into the settings the other day to try to adjust like the font size, because as I'm getting older, and I it's like I couldn't even, first of all, the settings, it just, the UI in Gmail, it's just, and Gmail's, you know, they've as a part of their 20th anniversary, they've done some interviews with the media. And they've talked about how, you know, with this big of a user base, it's, we have to consider changes very thoughtfully. And they take a long time because it affects so many people and there's so many ways it can go wrong. All true, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But just go into Gmail settings. It is a disaster of a UI.
That hasn't changed.
It is
never
horrible. Horrible. And I couldn't find out where to even change. What I could figure out to change the font of the, when I'm writing an email, like the default font it uses when it sends when I send an email. I can't find the font when I'm just reading email. It's just too small. I don't know. I've been thinking like I'm not going to switch from Gmail, but I'm thinking about like maybe trying Apple Mail, hooking it up to my Gmail again and see if I can use Apple Mail now.
That's what I do.
Do you? Okay. Yeah.
I used to try all these different mail clients and things like that, but at some point they...
Well, Apple Mail has failed for me in the past. It just couldn't handle the number of emails I have or something.
Oh, it's been fine for me.
It has? Okay. Yeah. I just should try it again. I do really love the defaults lifestyle. Like, honestly, now, I was Evernote forever, and the defaults lifestyle, I love it. I use reminders. Reminders have gotten so much better, and the Notes app continues. They're really investing in Notes.
That's my primary.
And about a year ago, I switched. I migrated, and I have a massive Evernote. I lived my life through Evernote. I migrated to Notes, and I have not looked back. Now, Notes doesn't have all the features. There's features, some features that are missing, and so for some people, it was a deal breaker. I didn't have any deal breaker missing features. Mm-hmm. And they've added new features since then. It's gotten a lot better, even in the past year. Mm-hmm. I mean, every release, they're really making Notes a lot. Now you can have links to other notes. They're just like little things, but they're big things.
Yeah.
I'm loving Notes. And it's so performant, and it just instantly, between all my different devices, my notes are all there. And Evernote the engineering got so bad on Evernote. Yeah. And I was a huge supporter of Evernote. I was an OG Evernote. Like, not OG, but, I mean... a decade at least. A decade of Evernote usage.
I remember it coming out.
And I paid them $200 a year, something like that. It's not cheap.
No.
Because I had the family thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's these OS tools have gotten a lot better, but they don't always cover all the scenarios. So you have to kind of like compromise and change your workflow a bit.
Yeah.
But I found that for most of what I need, it's okay.
I agree. Same thing with me. And yes, you know, some of these other Notes app have more features, but there are things that Notes does that's just so nice. Like, what was I doing the other day? Oh, I was in email. And I was like, it was when I was TDX. I was building a note just of all my receipts. So I can just do like one expense, right? And I, you know, of course, I would take some photos of some receipts. And of course, you can send those. I'd go right into the note and do the camera thing. Notes has the scan as a document. So it it knows you're scanning a document. So it does the contrast right. And it crops it and all that kind of stuff. Really nice. Evernote did a pretty good job of that, but Notes does that. So that's great. But you can also do things like I would get an email, like the hotel emailed me my receipt and I can just print the email. And I was on my computer. I just printed the email and I chose like PDF, but then you can say, just send this to a note. And I picked my receipt, my TDX like receipt note, and it just adds the PDF to that existing note with all those other receipts. It's just so many little things like that make it that they, it's small things, but you can tell they're taking notes seriously.
That's good. It's good for us. It's bad for the mom and pops who develop.
I didn't want to leave Evernote. I didn't want to leave. They just fell apart.
Yeah. The monetization of these applications is kind of odd, especially with everyone going to subscription based. Like syncing is a monetization feature. Like with some of these, you get the app, you can use it for free, but then you want to sync, and that's where you start paying. It's just
I
don't know, just charge me for the app. I mean, just make it work.
I don't think you can stay in business doing that. People wouldn't. It just wouldn't work. That's the problem with this app store. No one paying more than 99 cents for an app and all this other stuff. And people just basically not willing to pay for apps. It's just, again, a weird race to the bottom.
It is. I mean, I would much rather pay for a quality product once or annually or something.
Yeah.
Not nickel and dime me every month. Not hide every feature behind some paywall. It's getting insane.
I just feel like if you ask for that money up front, you can't sell your app.
I don't know. And half these things are, well, even websites like these sites that you buy into so you can read their articles.
Mm-hmm.
They're still showing you ads.
I know.
I complained to like Business Insider one time because I was really pissed that I was seeing so many ads. Like took over above the fold, probably like 50% of the above the fold.
Maybe your microphone's like around or something. It's in your.
It's in my what?
Well, your microphone's over there, but you're looking over at me over here, and yes. My mic's picking up more than yours is.
That's fine.
Right.
Okay. Your voice is better than mine.
I'm not talking.
Well, then stop picking it up. What was I ranting about?
Business Insider.
Business Insider.
Ads.
Yeah, it's just I just don't get it. They tell us that they need our support, that they need us to do this, and then they
out but then of, you pay them and they don't care about you.
Then, yeah, exactly.
You're like, wait a minute, what I get for what I just paid? My ads? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's the world we live in.
Well, John, one thing that's always gonna be free. It's Good Day Sir podcast.
That's true. Always free.
I was gonna say community, but
no bullshit ads.
I heard you weren't gonna monetize that.
You did hear that. Wow. yeah, no ads. We refuse to take ads. Mm-hmm. Actually, we always have. We get offers. Mm-hmm. People want us. I mean, why wouldn't you want us throwing an ad on the show? but we just I don't know. We've talked about that before. We just don't want any even just the appearance of bias or anything else. Like, I want to be able to talk about, you know, Capado or
mm-hmm.
anything, any of these things. And
well, this has always
been have it not be questioned like, oh, hey, they run Capado ads. Of course, they're going to like say, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't want that.
Yeah.
And that's not what this is about.
That's the
what is, John, what is this podcast about? And how do people get involved in this podcast, John, in this community?
It's about community, I was going to say.
Yeah. What you know, for people who are new to the show, how would they get more involved in the community?
You go to www.gooddaysirpodcast.com /community, or you can just click on community. There's a form to sign up. It's only semantics because I have to manually add you, but nothing happens after that. I just add you to the community and you're in.
And existing members can add themselves. It's a Slack. It's a Slack team. Team, is that what it's called? Or community? Or page? What? I don't know what it's called.
We're all Slackers.
Group, a Slack group?
Slackers.
Slack, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
A murder of Slackers? I don't know. What's the...
A murder of Slackers. Ooh. Hang on. I got to write that down. That's maybe a murder of Slackers. Probably too. That'd probably get us banned from using that title. Anyway. Yeah. Join our Slack if you haven't already. You can guess what we talk about. It's Salesforce stuff and silly stuff and helping each other out and whatever. Admins, developers.
Everyone. Admin developers.
Yeah. It almost sounds like an antelope or something, or a jackalope.
Oh, jackalope. Is it real?
Yeah.
I've seen one in the wild.
If you want to email us with your questions, comments, complaints, sticker requests, show suggestions, info@gooddaysirpodcast.com. And if you have a modern podcast app, I got to channel my inner Adam Curry here. If you have a modern podcast app, you can stream us sats or boost us.
Mm.
Now I do need to get set up so we can see boosts, but I can tell you, I don't think anyone has taken us up on any of this yet. So maybe our community is not on board with modern podcast apps and Bitcoin wallets and value for value and all that. But I think it's a cool technology, and that's what I use now to support podcasts I listen to. Love it. I think it's the future. It's worth checking out. But anyway, you can go to podcastapps.com. You can go to modernpodcastapps.com. You can go to newpodcastapps.com. These are all domains that point to similar, but not the exact same. Cause I noticed you get like a slightly different sorted list.
Yeah.
Of different, but people say like, if you're getting started, like, go to Fountain, just get the Fountain app
mm-hmm.
podcast, and it makes it easy to set up like your Bitcoin wallet so that you can like stream sats or boost your podcasts you listen to. I'm using Castomatic. I think it's a pretty good app. I'm talking to the developer right now. I got some things I'm working out, stuff, but it's a good app. It's you know, it's got all the things I want in terms of like, it's got the gap silent zapping. It's, you can play different speeds. You know, again, you can hook your Bitcoin wallet up to it. It's pretty, you're using Castomatic too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of, it's been choking on like the number of podcasts and episodes I have. That's one thing I'm working with him on.
I keep mine pretty clean.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, clean is good because I
don't hoard podcasts. I don't listen to it, I get rid of it. If I haven't listened to the episode, but if it's not one of the most recent three, I'm like, I gotta let it go. I didn't listen to it. It's okay.
And I'm really bad. My eyes are bigger than my mouth when it comes to podcasts.
You're a glutton.
I kind of am. I'm overly optimistic about how much I'm going to be able to listen to.
Yeah.
But anyway. All right, John. You got anything else for us?
No, that's all I got. And to that, I say good day, sir.
You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.